the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And our first article today is entitled, Guess What Kind of Cooking Oil is Tariff Proof? Written by Rachel Sugar. In the never-ending quest to figure out what we are supposed to eat, a new boogeyman has emerged, seed oils. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has pointed to seed oils, a category that includes common varieties such as canola, soybean, and corn, as a major culprit behind America's chronic disease problem. Kennedy is far from the only prominent seed oil critic. In his podcast, Joe Rogan has declared that, quote, seed oils are some of the worst things your body can consume, end quote. These claims about the dangers of seed oil are not based in science. Nutritionists believe that they are not only safe, but also good for you in moderation. But that hasn't stopped the charge against them from going mainstream. You can now find products labeled seed oil safe at Whole Foods and Costco. According to one poll, 28% of Americans are actively avoiding seed oils. So what are people eating instead? Kennedy's preferred alternative is beef tallow, a nutritionally dubious choice. But most grocery stores don't have family-sized tubs of rendered beef fat sitting next to the extra virgin olive oil. The obvious seed oil replacement, then, similarly vegetal, broadly familiar, delicious, is olive oil. Scientists and seed oil skeptics can agree on this. Olive oil. What an oil. Earlier this year, the fast salad chain Sweet Garden launched a limited-time-only seed oil-free menu featuring dressings made with olive and avocado oils chosen for their flavor but also for their health benefits and alignment with our values. But olive oil may soon cost more, potentially a lot more. Donald Trump's reciprocal tariffs, which he delayed by 90 days, are coming for the country's liquid gold. You know what is mostly insulated from the president's proposed plan? Seed oils. Consider vegetable oil the most ubiquitous of seed oils. No matter what brand you buy, it's likely made from American-grown soybeans. If the goal is to get people away from the seed oil, well, these tariffs are going to drive people into the arms of the seed oils. William Clifton Ridley, an agricultural economics professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, told me, seed oils, maligned by both the crunchy left and the MAHA right, may get their revenge. The biggest drawback of olive oil, ignoring certain culinary questions, has long been its price. Olive oil is not cheap compared with canola or vegetable oil. But since 2021, the average price of olive oil in the United States has roughly doubled, the result of climate change and rising production costs. Consider Wirecutter's budget olive oil pick, Bertolli Extra Virgin Olive Oil, Rich Taste. At Walmart, it currently costs $8.47 for 16.9 fluid ounces, the equivalent of a regular-sized Coke bottle. By contrast, 40 ounces of Crisco vegetable oil, equivalent to slightly more than a liter, will run you $4.47. The gulf is poised to only widen. That's because nearly all of the olive oil consumed in the U.S. is imported, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. As anyone who has gazed upon the bounty of the supermarket olive oil aisle can tell you, most of that is coming from the European Union, namely Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Greece. These products currently carry a 10% tariff. If Trump goes through with the sweeping fees he paused recently, that'll soon jump to 20%. Olive oil is also imported from some other countries, but the trouble is that the proposed tariffs are so global. A lot of olive oil comes from Tunisia, for example, which, under the president's paused plan, would be tariffed at 28%. Trump's tariffs are nominally intended to boost American manufacturing. These tariffs are going to give us growth like you haven't seen before, the president has promised. Except there is nowhere near enough homegrown American olive oil to go around. California, the rare state with conditions amenable to olive growing, produces less than 2% of the olive oil that Americans consume. California likes to think it produces olive oil, but not really, not to any great extent, Dan Sumner, an agriculture economist at UC Davis, told me. It wouldn't be easy to drastically ramp up domestic olive oil production. Olive trees can take at least 5 years to bear fruit. And with Trump repeatedly announcing tariffs and then pausing them, it's hard to expect American farmers to invest in this undertaking when they might not even recoup the benefits come 2030. Should Trump's more expensive tariffs take effect, olive oil prices might go up substantially, Ridley told me. Expect the sticker price of olive oil to increase somewhere from 10 to 20%. Enough, he said, to drive a sizable decrease in olive oil demand. Americans most certainly won't abandon olive oil en masse. It's olive oil, a kitchen staple. Nobody wants to drizzle their pizza with canola. But there's a huge swath of the population that's not going to be able to afford it, Phil Lempert, a grocery industry analyst, told me, and they're going to switch. And there are other options. Maybe seed oil skeptics will want to follow RFK Jr.'s lead and saute their food in beef tallow. But tallow isn't cheap either, and there isn't enough of it to go around. Last year, America produced about 1 pound of beef tallow for every 15 pounds of soybean oil, the most consumed oil in the U.S. by far. Compared with the alternatives, soybean oil will seem even cheaper. It is produced domestically. Imports are essentially zero. The same is true of corn oil, only a tiny fraction of which comes from abroad. The majority of canola oil is imported from Canada, meaning that, at least for now, it isn't subject to any new tariffs. You can debate these oils' relative merits and drawbacks, but you cannot debate the fact that they cost less. Even the more limited 10% tariffs that are now in place could lead to a seed oil resurgence. If the costs are passed down to consumers, Sumner told me, most people will suck it up and pay, but not everyone. Some people will shift to canola or vegetable oil. Restaurants perennially concerned about margins may be less likely to follow Sweetgarden's lead and give up seed oils. Your local Italian restaurant, Lempert pointed out, may already be saving money by blending their olive oil with canola, and that's before the tariffs. Though RFK Jr. is wrong about the health effects of seed oils, he's right about why they're so common. They're cheap. The reason they're in foods is that they're heavily subsidized, he told Fox and Friends, a point about seed oils he has made repeatedly. The federal government indeed pays American farmers to grow lots of corn and soybeans, allowing you to buy a jug of Crisco for less than $5. If the official governmental policy is to drive up prices on the most obvious alternative, seed oils will continue to have a leg up. Our second story, is a glass of wine harmless? Wrong question. By Emily Oster. Not long ago, alcohol was good for you. In a 1991 segment on 60 Minutes, a French researcher claimed that red wine consumption was responsible for good health in France. This argument proved popular with the wine-consuming public and prompted academic papers positing an inverse relationship between red wine consumption and cardiovascular disease. Scientists even put forward a mechanistic theory for why red wine was healthy, involving a compound called resveratrol. Others soon cast doubt on the possibility that red wine could really have any causal relationship with longevity. The alcohol is good for you narrative eroded, and in the past year seems to have fully collapsed. A number of researchers are now arguing that basically any amount of alcohol is bad for you. A New York Times article from January was titled, "Even a Little Alcohol Can Harm Your Health." Some, including the Canadian government, are suggesting that, as a result, the safest choice is not to drink at all. Excessive alcohol consumption clearly leads to significant problems, physical and emotional. That is not up for debate. However, recent rhetoric veering in the direction of abstinence goes well beyond the sound advice to avoid heavy drinking and ignores the value of pleasure. A pleasure-agnostic approach to health advice is now in vogue even outside the domain of alcohol and is filtering down to the general public with sometimes absurd results. Recently, a reader asked me, "Is there any data on the health benefits of orgasms?" I am not aware of reliable data from randomized experiments suggesting that having more orgasms improves health. That isn't the point of orgasms, anyway. The point of orgasms is that they are fun. We do not need to prove health benefits to want to have them. Public health advice is sometimes based on the lexicographic standard, putting the effects of health first, second, and third, and ignoring other considerations, including enjoyment. Lexicographic standard applied to, say, meat consumption would hold that we must always eat burgers well done because that is the best way to avoid any risk of E. coli, even though well-done burgers are tasteless. More generally, some in public health avoid discussing the negative, unintended consequences of absolutism. During the coronavirus pandemic, some officials advocated strongly for long-lasting school closures, arguing that keeping kids at home was the only way to prevent in-school spread among students and teachers. That was, in a technical sense, true, but this recommendation failed to consider the enormous costs to children of those closures, which should have been weighed against any benefits. Coming back to alcohol, pleasure agnosticism could make sense if the best available evidence indicated substantial harm from even moderate drinking. It does not. I should also stress that the data are fundamentally flawed because the largest, most commonly cited studies we have are observational, not randomized, and the characteristics of people who consume alcohol in moderation are different from those who do not. In 2018, The Lancet published a comprehensive study on the link between alcohol consumption and cancer, heart disease, and other illnesses. It is an extraordinary work of scholarship, combining hundreds of previous papers, and the results indicate an upward trend in cancer, in particular as alcohol consumption increases. But the effects at moderate levels of drinking, say 1 to 2 drinks a day, are very small. For heart disease, we see the familiar decrease in risk at moderate drinking levels and an increase with higher amounts. None of these results are convincingly causal. It seems very likely that all associations, positive and negative, are overstated relative to the truth. Generally, when researchers are able to adjust for some demographic differences, the relationship between alcohol and health gets smaller. This in turn suggests that if they could adjust for more differences, it would get smaller still. Whether these relationships would be smaller but still positive, or really zero, is something we cannot know from the data we have. We cannot conclusively prove that moderate alcohol consumption is totally benign, much less beneficial. Based on the data we have, It also seems extremely unlikely that moderate alcohol consumption is fully bad for your health. If you do not enjoy or actively dislike alcohol, then the abstinence standard might be the right one for you. But many people do enjoy a drink from time to time, a beer with friends, a cold glass of rosé in the summer, a hot toddy in front of the fire, even just a glass of white wine while cooking at the end of a long day. If we accept that pleasure has value and that data are muddy, then the moderation standard makes more sense. The pendulum on alcohol has swung too far from the 1990s. Alcohol is probably not the key to longevity, but it's not arsenic either. In the immortal words of Cookie Monster, it's a sometimes food. Today's third story is A Defense Against Gaslighting Sociopaths and was written by Arthur C. Brooks. What just happened, you're asking yourself? You knew in conversation that conversation would be tricky because you had to tackle someone about their misbehavior. Maybe it was a colleague who claimed your work idea as their own. Maybe it was a new friend who said nasty things behind your back. Or maybe it was a romantic partner who was unfaithful. The evidence is incontrovertible, so much so that had the boot been on the other foot, you would be confessing your error and asking for forgiveness. But that's not this person's MO. No, in the face of clear wrongdoing, they denied everything. Instead of showing contrition, they counterattacked, maybe even accusing you of the very behavior they committed. To top it off, they played the victim and cast you as the real offender. The whole interaction left you upset and confused, even questioning your perception. Is it possible that you got the whole thing backwards? Congratulations, you have just been mugged by DARVO, an acronym that stands for Deny, Attack, Reverse Victim, and Offender. DARVO is a technique we may well encounter in our daily life when dealing with sociopathic personalities. This type of person-to-person psychological warfare is designed to deflect any penalty for misbehavior and turn it instead into an opportunity to gain power over you. For a well-adjusted, mentally healthy person to be DARVO'd is a bewildering and unsettling experience. But once you understand how the technique works, you'll never have to be its victim again. The acronym was devised in 1997 by the University of Oregon psychologist Jennifer Fried, who has extensively studied domestic and sexual abuse and the characteristics of those who often perpetrate it. She observed that when confronted with evidence of their misconduct, abusers typically begin by denying or minimizing culpability. You're making a big deal out of nothing. Before accusing the victim of creating the problem, you regret what happened and now you're blaming me. And then reversing the roles of victim and offender. You should really be the one apologizing. Freud's work generally focused on the worst kinds of transgressions, but together with other researchers, she found that DARVO also commonly occurs when some people face criticism for more ordinary misbehavior. Scholars in 2017 asked 138 undergraduate survey respondents to recall an occasion when they'd confronted another person over a clear wrongdoing, which could include instances of personal abuse, social exclusion, or the silent treatment. The researchers found that the victims had experienced some degree of DARVO behavior in the majority of the confrontations reported. The study also discovered that women were almost 25% more likely than men to experience the technique, and that DARVO is disturbingly effective at eliciting some measure of self-blame in its victims. DARVO behavior has some features in common with gaslighting, a term that comes from the title of a 1938 British play in which an emotionally abusive husband manipulates his wife to convince her that she's losing her mind. The practice of deception and coercive control in classic gaslighting has led to a looser popular usage that describes how a perpetrator of harm, when called out for it, plays the victim by claiming that their action has been maliciously misinterpreted. You can see how Darvo-like this don't-believe-your-lying-eyes tactic is. This ploy is everywhere in politics, media, and the internet, anywhere, in fact, with a considerable population of bad faith actors. Some scholars argue that we must now inhabit a, quote, culture of offense, end quote, a way of turning a claim that some behavior or statement is offensive into, in effect, a right to be offended, which creates a further claim of victimhood. I expect that we can all think of examples of how this culture can be used as a cudgel to disingenuously keep disfavored views and voices out of the public realm. Researchers have even identified a phenomenon we could call gaslighting squared, when gaslighters themselves use an accusation of gaslighting against others. In this form of Darvo, they deny the charge of gaslighting, accuse you of gaslighting them instead, and achieve their victim-offender reversal that way. What type of person tends to gaslight others most effectively? The answer is the dark triad, an estimated 7% of the population I've written about previously who have above-average levels of three negative personality traits. Narcissism, it's all about me. Machiavellianism, I'm willing to hurt you to get what I want. And psychopathy, I feel no empathy for you and no remorse when I victimize you. Worried that you might be one? You can take a dark triad quiz. Researchers in 2021 showed that in young adults, gaslighting is closely associated with Machiavellianism and psychopathy. Gaslighting is also strongly tied to sadism. In other words, when an abuser's dupliciousness causes you confusion and misery, they get a kick out of that. Sadism is such a persistent feature of this personality type, in fact, that some scholars regard it as the fourth trait of a dark tetrad character. If you sense that people who repeatedly use Darvo on you are fundamentally off, you may be right. Neurologically, at least, people who belong to the dark triad are different from the rest of the population. Observation and analysis have determined that these people have lower brain volume than the general population in areas related to emotional regulation, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the cingulate cortex, and reward, the ventral striatum, the orbital frontal cortex. This is why curing a gaslighter is so hard. Indeed, dark triad traits, especially when full-blown psychopathy is involved, are almost impossible to remedy. But what about the victim of Darvo, the actual victim, not the self-proclaimed reverse one? For someone subjected to the technique, questioning whether the misbehavior really happened or whether they somehow misjudged the situation is actually an indicator of their emotional health. The very thing that makes you a decent human, in other words, is what the perpetrator seizes upon to induce doubt and self-blame. Susceptibility to this moral self-questioning is what Darvo aims to exploit. One useful tool to assess any interaction of this type that you may have had is Professor Fried's Darvo Experiences Questionnaire. An obvious course of action, if you believe you have been a Darvo victim, is to avoid the perpetrator in the future. Dark triads don't generally change their ways because they can't alter the gray matter governing their emotional regulation and reward systems. Further, their psychopathic tendencies make them incapable of remorse. If you're not sorry for doing something and it yielded the results you sought, you go on doing it. Even better is to identify a Darvo user before establishing a romance, a friendship, or a work partnership. One way to do this is by observing a person's internet activity, if you can. People with dark triad characteristics have been found to be especially drawn to what clinicians euphemistically call problematic social media use. Someone who's always getting into online fights, let alone trolling or doxing, may be inclined toward Darvo jujitsu. And if you discover that they are gaslighting people online, you can bet they will gaslight you in real life. Be aware and cut ties if you can. Try special care with dating. Dark triads can present as charming and captivating because they tend to be more invested in getting you to love them first than they are in establishing the basis of a mutually loving partnership. If you feel you're being swept off your feet, try to bring a healthy dose of skepticism to bear on this seeming dreamboat. Do your research, some digging into their social media profiles in particular. Are they very online? Do they get a lot of scraps? Are they gaslighting others? If so, move on. Finally, it should go without saying, but avoid using Darvo yourself. If you were a true dark triad, I doubt you'd have bothered reading this column. But gaslighting behavior isn't a binary phenomena. It comes in shades. Even a well-balanced person can lapse into some pathological interpersonal habits. If you think you may have indulged in some questionable retaliatory behavior, particularly when you felt criticized and defensive, go back to Freed's Darvo quiz above and interrogate your own communications, especially those involving some conflict. Most of us have probably been guilty of some version of this at some point. Do you find yourself ever playing the victim after having offended your romantic partner? Do you ever use attack as a way to fend off legitimate questions or accusations? Because the Darvo technique is so effective, you might have subtly adopted some of its features without even realizing. But you can be certain of this. Darvo destroys relationships. Use it persistently and you might find yourself gaslighting all the way to a divorce court. One last point. Many instances in life can involve genuine miscommunications and confusion. A contretemps in which someone's intent was not to offend you or hurt you, or when you were, in fact, thin-skinned. An honest person is open to that possibility, because none of us is perfect. A dishonest person, however, never admits to having misjudged another person, and will gladly turn defense into offense. So be alert to Darvo and learn to avoid the perpetrators. But be alert also to your own potential to be a Darvo perpetrator, even in a partial or temporary way. If you can accept criticism from others with grace and humility, and never try to turn the tables by claiming victimhood for yourself at their expense, you will be well defended against gaslighting, yours and theirs. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5111.